You're listening to KDRT LP 95.7 here in Davis, California. The program is That's Life, and my name is Lois Richter. Today I'll be telling you about my travels to San Diego, the plants that I saw there, and get Don Shore to ID them for me and tell me whether or not I can grow those here. There's also some talk about why the hills are so dry as you drive up I-5, and what about the farmers in the south part of the valley that are having to pull out or abandon their orchards and vineyards and things like that. Hope you enjoy the show. So, Don, I know you said that we couldn't afford the time to air all these really detailed explanations that you and I did about that San Diego plants. Is it okay with you if I put that on my show instead?
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea. And it's a more detailed discussion of some of the really cool plants you'll see if you go to one of my favorite parts of the United States, which is San Diego. There is an old joke about San Diego that the easiest job in the world is being a meteorologist in San Diego, California. Because the temperature range there is so even, so pleasant, so balmy, you can practically phone it in. I never saw a frost as a child. Occasionally would have a heat wave when the Santa Ana winds would happen in September. Other than that, I was on the coast, mid-70s, pretty much all through March through November. Mid-60s, November through March, and if it was below 60, Mom was cold and said you needed a sweater.
Okay, now I want to talk to you. I just got back from a two-week vacation in San Diego. I had a wonderful time. I went to the zoo. I went to the botanical gardens. I walked around town and took pictures of all sorts of flowers. And so I sent Don a couple of pictures asking you, can you ID this thing, et cetera, and so forth.
Sure.
And I want to talk today about a couple of things. First of all, I'm going to show Don some pictures. We're sharing our screen here. And do you know what this bush is? It's got beautiful, exciting little flowers, little pink starburst things. Is this a spice bush?
Nope. Gruia caffra. And coastal listeners will love this plant. And in the interior, we can also grow it. It is a plant that's hardy enough to grow here in the valley. The common name, lavender star flower. It's in this category of a sprawling shrub, not a true vine, but it's usually sold as or used as if it were a vine. It's one of those ones where it arches and sprawls, and so you tie it up on a wall somehow or a trellis, and then you take advantage of the fact that it arches and sprawls, and it gives you these beautiful little bursts of lavender flowers pretty much all through the growing season, even into the winter if it doesn't get too cold. And here, when we get below about 29, 30 degrees, you get a lot of defoliation, but it resprouts quite readily. So it's in the category of reasonably hardy subtropical. Bougainvilleas are in the same category, and you use it much the same way. It's not going to climb itself up onto something. So if you want to make use of it that way, you need to provide for support for this plant. There's lots of plants in this category. Or if you have room for it to just arch out and sprawl in your garden, it's great for that as well. So lavender star flower, Gruia caffra. This one is hardy enough to grow in the interior parts of Southern California, as well as in the valley here in Northern California.
So it has woody stems, I see. Yes. And, but would this be a candidate for a Berkeley, flower box, window box trailing down? Would this be a good candidate?
It's a big plant. So as with anything like that, it's like putting a bougainvillea in a hanging basket. And it's very similar in its usage. They exist. There are varieties that are used for that purpose. It'll get very root bound very quickly. Again, you can keep a plant in a container forever. if you provide it what it needs, which is sufficiency of water and occasionally externally provide some nutrients. When I worked in the Botanical Conservatory greenhouses, we had some tropical trees in there that had been in the same pots for 40 years. We grew them because we needed a member of that family for a particular lab class. We didn't have room for it to turn into a 60-foot tree, so we kept it in whatever seemed like the biggest pot we could manage. It got watered every day. It got fertilized actually every day. You don't have to do that yourself, but you have to fertilize it regularly. But sure, it's a great container plant. And in fact, it's popularly used for that. As I mentioned at the outset, it's used for bonsai. And there's a case where you're constraining the roots completely. So a big barrel, if you don't want to have to prune it all the time or water it constantly. But yes, in the Bay Area, this is a very popular plant. Gruia caffra, lavender starflower.
All right. And then I believe that the image I'm showing you here is some sort of milkweed, but it's bright red with bright orange centers. And it's a gangly stalk with a few flowers on the end of each. Is this a milkweed? And is this
one of the more popular milkweeds for garden centers called Asclepias tuberosa. It's not actually, oh, no, wait a minute, is that tuberosa? No, you have the tropical one there. It's a subtropical plant, once again, that we grow to draw the butterflies, of course. And this one freezes down in our climate, and in that climate, it doesn't. So this is a big difference. And it's a big source of controversy and conversation amongst native plant enthusiasts versus people who just want to draw butterflies and aren't that concerned about where the plant came from. Yes, this one does draw butterflies for sure, not just milkweed, not just monarchs, by the way. All kinds of butterflies go to Asclepias flowers. The reason this one's popular with garden centers is that it blooms the first year from seed. So they can grow it and put it in a 4-inch pot or a quart pot. It'll bloom even in that small pot. So it's the first one you're likely to see in garden centers in the spring. When you come in April looking for milkweed, this is the first one we're all likely to have. The others come along. Our native milkweeds here take 2 years to bloom, sometimes 3 years to bloom. They become a saleable plant after about 9 to 16 months in a container. So the growers have to put a whole lot more time and effort into them. This one is practically effortless. And it's got these bright orange and yellow flowers, very attractive, the same interesting, strange structure that all the milkweed family flowers have. You ever look at them, they're very recognizable. Everything in that family, Asclepiadaceae, have interesting flower structure that's co-evolved with particular pollinators. And this is an easy one to grow, but yes, it's a tropical, or I should say technically subtropical milkweed. Now, the reason this one's controversial, aside from the fact that a lot of native plant enthusiasts only want you to plant native milkweeds, that this one keeps blooming all the time in USDA Zone 10, which is the coastal parts of California and Southern California, where it doesn't frost. It even continues into the winter. And the opinion of some is that that causes monarchs to stick around when they should be migrating. And therefore, also, they can build up particular disease problems, the cycle of which is broken up by the migration and other factors. Dr. Shapiro, butterfly expert here at UC Davis, says really simply in the interior, it just freezes. So that problem is solved. Almost anywhere outside of sunset zones 17 and 24 or outside of USDA zone 10. So this applies to southern Texas and Florida as well. Outside of those zones, this one just dies. And so your cycle, your problem is taken care of. If you're concerned about that disease buildup, if you're concerned about breaking up the migratory cycle, cut it back. Just cut it down every now and then. I guarantee it'll come back. Very, very easy to grow. Grown here as an annual, grown there as a perennial.
All right. Now, the next one was sort of a tree bush thing. It was a tree, but it wasn't very big. And all the ones I saw were short trees. So this one has those multiple leafleted pinnate flowers and, I mean, leaves and beautiful, huge clusters of bright gold five-petaled flowers. What is it?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Next. Okay. Next. I'm gonna edit that out. I'm gonna edit that whole part out. Next.
All right.
Actually, it's gold. We'll back up here. I was being flippant. It's golden medallion tree. Golden medallion tree. And it's all over Southern California, and it is a cassia. They're quite beautiful. They weren't planted. I was joking because they didn't have those down there when I was growing up there. And then I'd go down and visit my folks, and I'd arrive at the Lindbergh Field Airport. And as you're driving out all along the exit to Lindbergh Field, you'd see these big yellow, these not big, small, as you would describe them, trees with yellow flowers. And it's Cassia leptophylla gold medallion tree, which were widely planted in the 90s, which is after I had moved away from Southern California. There are cassias that'll go down to 25 degrees. We get to 25 degrees here pretty routinely. I know a lot of people in our area don't think we do, but we do. We did just last year get to 27 degrees, and the year before we got to 25 degrees. Not night after night, but it happened. So the gold medallion tree, which is a cassia, has beautiful crowns of yellow flowers. Cassia as a group is huge. There are cassias and sennas, which all have yellow flowers, as far as I know, yellow to orange to maybe shades of brownish red, but mostly bright golden yellow, mostly with divided leaves like you're describing. Some of them are hardy. Most of them are tender. A few of them become quite invasive by reseeding. The pods are quite interesting. They're relatively drought tolerant. Some are extremely drought tolerant can take actually no irrigation once established. So it's a big group of plants. Anybody going to Southern California is likely to see the gold medallion tree. And if you're within Los Angeles Basin, San Diego, interior parts, not too high up into the mountains behind, you can probably grow this tree. It'd be comparable in terms of its usage in your landscape as a crepe myrtle, that kind of thing.
All right. So then as I was walking around, I saw these combinations of plants. Some seem to have ivy geraniums and these purple, I can't remember the name of them. They were houseplants when I was in college. Yeah. Can you remember the name of these purple leaf things?
Yes, Tradescantia pallida. The Tradescantias we now call inch plants, or we just call them Tradescantias. There's a whole bunch of different kinds, as Zebrinas, Tradescantias, with this particular one. I have a bunch of this one with this purple foliage. The flower is insignificant. The plant sprawls out and then down. It's used as a filler plant for hanging baskets, getting back to our first topic, and just grown for the foliage. And it's perfectly hardy here in the Sacramento Valley. And you can just take any kind of cutting and stick it in anything, water, soil, whatever. It's one of those kinds of plants. And it mixes very nicely. The picture Lois is showing me is it's mixed with ivy geranium. Jeff, head out and get some red purple leaf Tradescantia. Let me know. I got a bunch of it. I'll bring some cuttings for you. And mix it with whatever else you have, because it's mainly grown just for that really interesting contrasting foliage.
All right. Here's a bush that...
Oh, there's a plant I grew up with.
It used as a hedge. It looks like something I'm familiar with from Hawaii. It smells exactly like the stuff in Hawaii, but I don't know what it is. What is it, huh?
I grew up with this plant, natal plum. Natal natal plum, N-A-T-A-L, Carissa grandiflora. What you didn't get in your picture is the extraordinary thorns that it has, which are quite striking. And it is a very popular shrub in Southern California, but not hardy. I grew up with this one. One of the houses right near me had a whole hedge of it, gave great privacy. The flowers are constant. It has a sweet fragrance to the flower. It's kind of a jasmine-like flower fragrance, I guess. And then these striking, but okay, they're edible, but they're not very good.
They're technically edible.
Yeah, they're edible. They're quite astringent to me. I've certainly tasted many of them over the years. And people who go on about natal plums being good, well, I think you're putting them in something with a lot of sugar to make them palatable. They're great for throwing. Fit perfectly in a, perfectly in a slingshot.
Speak the child in you.
This hedge was really well positioned right next to a busy road. So, I mean, you know, you're asking a 10-year-old boy to walk by a hedge with red fruit hanging on it that fit in a slingshot. I mean, come on, you're just asking for trouble.
But so would this plant, do you remember a few weeks ago when we had someone who wanted to have, they were right on the street and they wanted to have something in front of the windows to, you know, sort of protect the windows. Would this plant with its thorns be a good candidate, or would it get tall?
Oh, definitely. Yes, it would. And those thorns are irritating. There's a latex in this Carissa that irritating to the skin. So this is definitely in the range of a barrier plant. It's described as preferring alkaline soil conditions. It's very, very tough and adaptable. When I worked in a nursery down there years ago, we had dwarf versions and full-size versions. I would not be surprised if there are more forms of natal plum now. Very popular all along the coastal zones, but only hardy to about 30 degrees. So not something that we could grow reliably here in Sunset Zone 14, but very popular down there.
Okay, another thing that I saw quite commonly were these beautiful leaf plants. And I'm showing Don a picture of, there's a bright red leaf, there's a rusty orange leaf, there's a golden and yellow leaf. And then some of them have little tiny stalks of delicate white flowers. What are these plants, Don?
These are coleus.
Are they all coleus?
They appear to be, and coleus have become much more diverse than they were in the past. Once upon a time, coleus was a house plant only, and that was how it was sold. And now coleus is a garden plant as a bedding annual for the shade. Now, it's not technically an annual in the sense of growing, flowering, seeding, and dying. It's an annual in the sense that when we get to 31 degrees, it melts and dies, not just to the ground, but completely. So there's been a lot of breeding on coleus over the years. And the name has changed, by the way, but we're going to keep calling it coleus. We all knew one species, coleus blumei, B-L-U-M-E-I. And that was what was in the trade. And there's a bunch of other species now. And breeders have had fun with these. I think this is one of the side benefits of downy mildew on impatiens, is that it caused a lot of breeders to look for alternatives. And while there have been breeding programs going on forever about coleus or fibrous begonias or this, that, or the other, impatiens so overwhelmingly dominated the bedding plant industry for shade color that there wasn't much room left for any of these other plants. Well, downy mildew hit 10, 12 years ago and started wiping out impatiens all over the place. And bedding plant industry is huge. It's a very high value industry. And the breeders just scrambled, one, to come up with downy mildew resistant impatiens, which they have, but two, to come up with alternatives to impatiens, which I think is the biggest benefit of that whole thing. Whole bunch of new types of coleus on the market, very, very dwarf types, great big types, spreading, trailing types. I mean, you have coleus for every situation now, bearing in mind that if you're anywhere that you could get below 32 degrees, it's an annual. It's going to function as an annual. In completely frost-free zones in California, Sunset Zone 24, where I grew up right there, where you can see or smell the ocean was the old designation of Sunset Zone 24, or Zone 17, which is like Berkeley on the water, where you simply don't get frost typically, coleus could make it through the winter. Also, if you see one you really like, because there's an amazing range of colors on the foliage and growth habits on these, they're incredibly easy to root. I mean, if you want a project with young kids, rooting coleus in water is one of the simplest things you can do. It's in the mint family. Roots will come out at the base of every leaf node. You can just take a 6-inch piece of coleus, strip off the leaves from the bottom half, and just put it in a vase that you can watch the roots form that way if you want to do this with kids. Easy to do right in potting soil as well. So if there's one you really like and you don't think you're going to be able to buy it next year at a garden center, go ahead and root it in the brightest window that you have. Get it through the winter as a house plant. And as soon as you're past any danger of frost, you can move it up to a bigger pot and put it back outside. So coleus are easy. There's an amazing color range. There's all these different sizes now. They're one of the best colorful plants you can do for just seasonal summer and fall color in the shade. And you can also still grow them, of course, as house plants.
So we could tell Jeff, if he wanted to, he could have another basket with trailing coleus.
You could have any kind of coleus in it, and it'll be spectacular. And they always used to tell us to pinch off the flowers when they would bloom. And finally, after doing that for years, I thought, why am I doing this? The flowers are perfectly attractive. The plant doesn't die when it blooms. They're just telling you to do that to keep it, I don't know, bushier or more attractive or something, or you didn't want flowers falling on your counter. You do not have to remove the blossoms of coleus if you don't wish to.
And if you get out a hand lens and look at them, those are pretty flowers. They're tiny. There's like pinhead size, but they're very lovely. Okay, so the next one, I have seen this plant before. It looks like a black rose-shaped plant, but it's a succulent. And I've seen it, but I don't know what it is, and I don't know if we can grow it here.
This is one of my mother's absolute all-time favorite succulents, and she was a succulent collector and grower for years and years and years. Aeonium, A-E-O-N-I-U-M, aeonium, which is the group of succulents that look like hen and chicks with stems. Ah. That help. They have the same rosette shape as a hen and chick, Echeveria, but it gets taller and taller. And so they tend to be upright anywhere from 6 to 12 inches up to 3 feet or more. And there's some really big aeoniums. And then this particular one is Zwartkop, Z-W-A-R-T-K-O-P, Zwartkop. I'll tell you two things about it. One, it's harder to propagate than most succulents. It just doesn't root a lot of the time. She would find there were certain times of year when it rooted and times when it didn't. I don't remember what she said about that. So if you're trying to grow it from cuttings, be aware that unlike a lot of succulents where it's just literally stick them in something and they grow, this one was more challenging and slower growing. So she never had as many of them as she wanted. Also, the intensity of the color changes. If it's in more sun, it's blacker. It's almost black. If it's in more shade, it's greener and more open, but still very attractive. And here in the valley, full sun for this plant will burn it. So here we put it in light shade and it's still very, 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 very dark, but not as dark as this amazing picture that you came up with here. Full sun in San Diego, yeah, it'll be black. And my mother had one right out in her patio, which was right there at coastal San Diego, which was a full sun patio. But what that means in coastal San Diego is fog until noon. Okay. We didn't go to the beach until 1 or 2 in the afternoon. The fog would reliably burn off by then. You went to the beach until 5 or 6 p.m. Then you'd go down to the cliff and watch the fog roll back in. So full sun in San Diego is not full sun in the Sacramento Valley. And so down there, she had it right out in the sun in her patio. She also had fuchsias out in full sun in her patio. Okay, it's a different climate. So there, they were very intensely colored. And she would bring me cuttings, and we'd put them where our succulents did well, where it was only morning sun or the shade of a shade structure we had built. And they would get more open and less dark, but still very attractive. So that's Aeonium Zwartkop. Everybody's attracted to aeoniums in any assortment of succulents that you put out. And succulents are extremely hot right now, continuing like 5-6 years now, this amazing trend of people growing and collecting succulents. Those of you listening in the USDA Zone 9 or colder, aeoniums are mostly tender. Mm-hmm. You need to know as you're buying and collecting succulents, which ones are going to be able to make it through the winter in your region and which one outside and which ones would need to be protected. And so as we get close to winter, about Halloween is my threshold for this, because that's usually about 3 weeks away from our first frost here. We go out and we just start sorting through the succulent display. And we pull the fuzzies, the calanchoas. We pull the jade plants and their relatives, the crassulas. We pull the aloes that I know are tender versus the ones that I know are hardy. And we pull the aeoniums. And we put them in flats and we move them closer to the building. We move them right up next to the east-facing wall where they would probably be 3 to 4 degrees warmer on a cold night than they would be if they were out in the open. And that's usually sufficient for us here in Sunset Zone 14, basically the same as Sunset Zones 8 and 9 in this regard, or USDA Zone 9 in general. If I see that we're going to have a cold snap, where they're saying that it's going to be very cold and still and drop down into the upper 20s, we have these all in flats right near the building. We just, at the end of the day, pick them up, carry them inside, set them on the floor in the shop, close up and go home, come back in the morning, put them back out. So that they're just protected that night. That's all we need to do. But I know that succulents are incredibly popular right now. The nursery industry is just scrambling to keep up with this demand that's been going on for 5-6 years now, where they're as popular as houseplants, and it's not waning at all. And you need to know that there's a lot of ones that you may be buying if you're listening in a much colder climate that you're just going to have to treat as annuals or figure out whether you have a window that you can get them through the winter in. There are hardy succulents, sedums, delospermas, things like that. But there's also quite a lot of them that we're all selling to you that are not hardy in colder climates than USDA Zone 9. It always disturbs me a little bit because I'll see this in popular media where they'll show succulent collections in New York or someplace like that. And I'll think, are these people really going to replace half, 3/4 of those plants next year? Are they aware that they're not hardy? This is my biggest concern. Have you been informed that this plant you're buying is likely to freeze at 28 degrees? So do a little research, and these are in the likely to freeze at 28 degrees category.
Okay, so that leads me into my next question. And this is, again, triggered by my being in San Diego, which is a climate where it doesn't get nearly as hot as we do, and it doesn't get nearly as cold as we do. And summer seems to be just about the same as winter. It's like a universal 24/7 kind of thing. Okay.
Yes. The easiest job in the world is being a meteorologist in San Diego, California. Although having said that, because we have listeners down there, I am aware that interior San Diego County gets very hot and quite cold.
Yeah.
So listeners in Escondido are saying, what do you mean we don't get hot? Yes, Escondido gets 106, just like we get to 106. So you're talking about the coastal belt of San Diego.
Yeah. So here's my question. Now, you said this looks like hen and chicks. Hen and chicks is not related. Is that correct?
Same family, but different genus. Yeah.
Okay. And hen and chicks is hardy here.
Yes.
And hardy much colder than here. I know that because we had them back.
Somewhat colder than here. Yeah. Yeah.
Back in Wisconsin, we had hen and chicks.
Really?
So, yeah. Wow. So here's the question. What is it in the physiology of the plant that means that it will or will not be able to tolerate going down to 25? What is the difference?
Plants make antifreeze in their leaves and stems.
Is that sugar in water? Is that when you say antifreeze, you put antifreeze sugar in water, it doesn't freeze as quickly?
Correct. Antifreeze is propylene glycol, actually, and in plants, it's ethylene glycol. I think I might have those backwards because I don't have my textbooks in front of me. But it's anything with sugar or salt in it will freeze at a lower temperature than just pure water. And so plants that have adapted, evolved with a steadily cooling and then colder and then below freezing temperature as the season goes along, in many cases, will change the cell contents to have more salt or more sugar in the leaf and stem, and in some cases, even more interesting compounds that make them able to go down much, 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 much colder. There are certain critical threshold temperatures, 31 degrees for truly tropical plant. Well, truly tropical plants shouldn't go below 55. Okay, plants from Tahiti, if they go below 55, they go into a decline process. Photo inhibition begins to occur and a bunch of other stuff happens. So you don't leave your pothos out on the porch as we get into colder weather. It's not just freezing weather, it's just colder, even colder weather there. Yeah, I know people who have them outside and you can watch what happens to them as we get colder here. But others can go down to about 27, 28 degrees without much difficulty because they can change the solution that's in the cells, that's in the leaves, that's in the stems. And you may get some leaf damage or some top damage, but enough of the plant will come through. You get down to about 26, 27 degrees. To me, that's a critical marker for a lot of plants. And so there's shrubs, for example, from Australia, grevilleas, 500 species and cultivars. And before I stock them at my nursery, I want to look at the cold temperature that they've been rated for. A whole bunch of them go down to 29, 30 degrees. I don't sell those because we get there routinely. A bunch of them go down to 25 degrees. Okay, people need to know you can grow this one, but it's marginal because we get to 25 degrees. I keep saying this to people and they look at me like, no, we don't. Yes, we do. And then there's a whole bunch that go down to 18 to 20 degrees. Presumably, those have even different solutions, if you will, in the leaf and stem that allow them to survive to lower and lower temperatures. Then you think about the more extreme elements of trees that grow at very high elevations, very high latitudes, mostly conifers and things like that, all kinds of fascinating compounds in the leaves and the stems that allow them to survive well below freezing. But it basically is a change in the solution of what's in the leaf and the stem. It usually requires that it be a fairly gradual transition to colder temperatures. So an early frost, let's say we were to get a frost here on Halloween instead of Thanksgiving, it would probably do more damage. I know it would do more damage than if we had our steady decline in temperatures and then got a frost as the nights were getting colder and colder and colder. The plant has changed its metabolic pathways and gets a different solution in the leaf and stem. If it happens abruptly, hasn't had a chance to do that. So the first frost generally does more damage than subsequent frosts as the plants have adapted individually to the changing temperature. But it's a change in the chemistry of the leaf and the stem.
Okay, that leads me to two questions. One is, why doesn't the plant just keep the antifreeze in its cells all the time?
Presumably it's an energy cost to make these different metabolic pathways. We'll just make that assumption.
Okay. And the second one is you say, well, the first frost kills more things than the second frost. Well, yeah, by the time the second frost comes around, the first things are dead.
Depends on what they are. The first frost will do more to an otherwise hardy plant. An early frost will do more damage than a later frost.
Okay.
If it's a gradual transition, the plant, there's all, every time sunlight strikes a leaf and the pigments are excited, it sparks all these metabolic pathways of the byproducts of photosynthesis, and they change. They change at different temperatures and different conditions. That actually is a function in leaf color. As we get into fall leaf color, we'll talk about that when we get the leaves changing color here. As you have that happening, some of those are an expense to the plant in terms of the energy use, and plants are always trying to conserve energy, at least in theory. And so it'll happen as an adaptive strategy, but it's not something that the plant would be doing under more optimal conditions.
Okay, thank you. All right, so back to the pictures that I'm showing, Don. This one is some strappy leaves, light green, a stalk, and then a whole bunch of, well, they look like bells. The actual individual flowers look like naked ladies, but the plant doesn't look at all like that. It's very delicate and very light, but they're pink and they're lily-shaped. And what are they, Don?
Your statement about them looking like naked ladies is probably correct. It's either a crinum lily or an amacrinum lily. I had a neighbor in my neighborhood in La Jolla who was a USDA agricultural scientist. So his field of research was actually lettuce. He bred most of the iceberg lettuce that became standard in the industry. He also bred squash, as he called them, and pumpkins, and collected them. He was one of the foremost experts on the family Cucurbitaceae. And as a hobby, this tells you what my neighbors were like, he hybridized amaryllis and crinums. So that was I was 14 years old when I saw my very first amacrinum, where he had taken amaryllis, naked lady, and crossed it with crinum lily, which I already had some of from my grandfather. And they cross because they're closely related. And the amacrinums are just amazing bulbs. Unlike the naked lady, they don't die down when they're blooming. Their foliage is there all the time. Like the naked lady, it's a tubular flower that opens up, but there's different shades of pink to red. There's even some that are very, very dark pink. Very easy to grow down to USDA zone 9. I don't think you're going to go much colder than that because the fleshy stems would be damaged by very cold temperatures. In 1990, we had a freeze here where we got to 16 degrees. Now, I had crinum lilies my grandfather had given me, and I still have these plants. He gave them to me in the 1970s. So I have these plants now, had them for, that would be about 50 years. And that year, I thought we lost them. They melted, killed to the ground. Okay, well, maybe they'll come back. They did. They came back. They didn't bloom that year. So they're almost hardy here. And I think if you get down into USDA zone 8, that'll probably be an annual event rather than an intermittent event. You might just not ever see them bloom. I don't know. Perhaps in colder climates, you can grow the amacrinums, but I don't think so. So this is either a crinum or an amacrinum. And yes, in our zone, USDA zone 9, sunset zones 8, 9, and 14, you can grow them. They're big plants, big robust plants with big strappy leaves and these flowers that stand up 5 feet above the ground. My stand of them that I had in my garden there in coastal San Diego was a patch about 8 by 10. It produced 40 or 50 blooms of pure white flowers that are that super musky, sweet smell that lilies have, a very similar kind of smell, sort of like a cross between a daffodil and a lily. So pleasant to excessive in some cases. We use them regularly for weddings and things like that. People would come if their wedding was at the right time and cut them because they were unbelievably easy to grow. They were also not just magnets, but high-rise condominium complexes for snails. Oh. I mean, the snails in those beds were amazing to the point that those of you in coastal zones will know what I'm talking about here. The French garden snail, which is one of our major backyard pests here in California, is year-round in the coastal areas because it has the moisture that they need. They have dampness in the morning. They have dampness in the early evening. They can get out and do a lot of damage. So they're one of our major pests. Here in the valley, one of my great joys of moving to the interior part of California was that snails became seasonal. They're a big problem in the spring, and they're a problem in the fall when we reach the dew point again. But I don't see snail damage in July. It's too dry for them to do well here. And so there can be a problem in an overgrown garden, but they're very seasonal. I used to take a sickle, sharpen it, and cut this patch of crinum lilies to the ground once a year, take all this stuff, get rid of it, put it in my father's compost pile, rake up 300, 400, 500 snails that were on the ground, put them in whatever it took to get rid of them, and sort of start over. And that's because crinums, like agapanthus and other big beds of leafy stuff like that, become not just habitat, but breeding sites for the garden snail.
All right. Well, those were the ID questions that I had for you. And then I want to talk about a couple of things that I noticed on the way down and on the way back from San Diego. Now, we drove. So we drove Highway 5, hot, dry valley, over the mountains into the LA Basin and on down to San Diego. And one of the places that I went while I was in there was a wonderful mosaic garden. It's an art exhibit. It's called a garden. It's called Magic Garden, but it's actually mosaics. And in there, they had, this is in Escondido. I encourage anyone who is interested in that to give me a call, and I'll gladly share the information with you. But in Escondido, there's this giant wall of mosaics, and it's a giant snakes in a big circle. And the wall is like 5 to 7 feet tall. And there are openings occasionally with a little dirt in it and stuff growing in it, but they're not watered at all. And so over the years, the rest of the things that were in there have declined. And now the only one left is this thing. And it's obviously a cactus, branching cactus with lots of thorns and all that sort of stuff. Maybe it's a choya. I'm not sure about cactuses, but it's the only thing left. And it has never been watered. Given that the rainfall last year was so small, I'm amazed that any of the plants have survived. So first of all, can you confirm with me that A, it's a cactus, and B, maybe it's a choya?
Oh, yes. I'm very familiar with jumping cactus. They're all over San Diego County and into the desert areas there. And anybody who's gone hiking in that area knows where the name comes from. They detach quite readily, attach themselves to you. And they have thorns that resemble fish hooks, so they're hard to take out. And most of us who have encountered choyas become rather hostile to them. But they are very, 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 very tough. Remember, the average rainfall, San Diego is less than 10 inches a year. So low rainfall is normal, and botanical gardens down there have been adapted to that for quite a long time. Certainly, my mother, with her cactus garden or succulent garden out front in San Diego, was basically only irrigating plants when they got put in, and then occasionally, if they were shallow rooted and showed some stress, she would hand water them. That was that. That was all she had to do. She was well ahead of her time then. Growing up there, I did have neighbors with lawns, although I will say that it was a fairly eccentric neighborhood. And with a lot of PhDs, and they all had their own ideas about what to do. And so there was one with a zoysia lawn. There was another one with a very dwarf Bermuda grass lawn. And others who had traditional lawns gradually, over the years, over the many droughts we went through in the 1970s, where it was even drier down there, they started taking out their lawns. And in Southern California, that's been trend for decades now. And when I went down to visit in my parents' later years, there was not a single lawn left in a front yard in that whole neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And in fact, many of them had planted cactus and succulents, particularly succulents. Cactus in your front yard, as my mother could tell you, can have some drawbacks because they're thorny. And she actually had a jumping cactus, a choya, out in the front yard. And after like the third or fourth kid got into it and had to pull, you had to pull them out with pliers and stuff, she finally decided, okay, well, her attitude generally was, cactus, thorns, kids will learn, but that one became problematic. So she removed those from the cactus garden. But she had a lot of succulents, and they are a classic way to landscape in Southern California. Agaves and aloes. You have many frost tender aloes that are spectacular. She had a huge aloe out front in the garden that's still there. The people who bought the house were so impressed with it. 6 feet across, starts blooming in early December and blooms right through the winter. So it's always in bloom at Christmas time. I have loads of pictures of this plant with blooms 5-6 feet up in the in the air over this plant that's a 4-foot bush in full bloom with hummingbirds all over it in the middle of the winter. So you have lots and lots of options there for succulents, many of which are too tender to grow here. We can grow a lot of very cool low water cactus and succulents here as well. And I should mention, cactus in general are very cold hardy. Cactus, true cactus, for the most part, can live with winter cold with no problem. There are cactus that are native all the way up into Wyoming. There are some truly tropical cactus and a few subtropical cactus, and those tend to be grown and sold as houseplants. Like Christmas cactus, for example, is too tender to grow outside reliably here, unless it's in a sheltered location. It's about as hardy as a jade plant. So it goes down to 29, 30 degrees. Much below that, you'll start to get some injury on it. But all the regular cactus, the ones you're thinking of with spines and things like that, can go down into the mid to low 20s with no problem. If you've ever been to the Mojave Desert in the winter, which I have, it gets down to 20 degrees routinely. What their greatest risk actually isn't cold, it's rot. And so rainy periods where the water doesn't drain away from them, then you can have problems. So if you decide you're going to do a cactus and succulent garden, one of the simplest things to do is create a gentle mounded area so that water, when there's an excess of it all at once, will percolate away from the plants and not stand nearby them. So water standing around the roots of any plant, this goes for all you folks back east who are dealing with all the rainfall right now, water standing around the roots of any plant for about 24 hours is going to lead to problems. It's going to make those roots or stem vulnerable to the water molds, a bunch of different kinds. We've talked in the past about Phytophthora and our problem with a particular type of it here is a high temperature, high water, high moisture problem. But there are species of water molds that are problems in areas where it's cooler and wet. So be aware that if you're in an area where you're getting one of these incredible rainstorms, 2, 3, 4 inches of rain all at once, and water is collecting around plants, there are many plants where you need to make sure it drains away. That's probably the most important thing you can do. But in general, cactus are surprisingly hardy and, of course, quite drought resilient.
So I've been asking you details about specific plants. Mm-hmm. If I were not sitting here having you on the screen and talking with you, I were just at home, I'm just a listener, how would I go about easily identifying a plant that I saw when I was on vacation? Is there a place that one can simply send a picture and get an ID? Or is there, do you have to key it out like a botanist? What do you do?
Oh, it's gotten much easier than the old days. Let me tell you, when we had to key some, my day, when we had to walk uphill to school in the snow.
Both ways.
In La Jolla, where it never snowed. If you wanted to identify a plant, you had Hortus Third, you had the Western Garden Book, you had Bailey's Manual, you had them all out. And yes, you were.
But this isn't 1800, Don. What do we do?
This is not the 1970s. What actually works really well is Google Images is incredibly helpful if you have a starting point. If you know what family it's in, if someone who can look at the flower can say, oh, that's in Bignoniaceae, and then you know that you're in San Diego, you can start kind of narrowing it down with those Google search terms, where you were, what family it's in, what color it is, hit Google Images, up will pop a picture, a bunch of pictures, obviously, scroll through them, really good chance of finding it that way. Honestly, if you narrow it down by certain criteria that you can maybe get a little help with, and having the family or knowing roughly what family it is actually a very good starting point. Plant identification groups on Facebook are incredibly useful. And I'm aware of two that have many, many, many members. One is just called Plant Identification. They have really rigid rules. You post a picture, you post exactly where you are. You don't abbreviate your state because we need to know exactly where you are. And that's it. And you do not discuss whether it's edible, poisonous, medicinal uses, anything. All we're there for is the botanical name. And in fact, common names are frowned on because they're misleading, although they can put it in the context of it. So you look at it and 10 people will come in who know plants. Consensus will emerge typically very, very quickly. Because of everybody wanting to chit-chat about them, and I use this and it seeds all over my yard, all that stuff that breaks the rules and they throw people out all the time for it, a parallel group called Plant Idents was created. Say whatever you want. Tell us how you cook it. Tell me how many of your family members died when you made a buy out of it. We don't care because that's okay in that group, Plant Idents. Plant Identification, you'll get a fast answer. And there's thousands and thousands of members, and so they want to keep it moving. So if you prefer cut and dried, here's the answer. That's your group. Plant Idents, this is more of a coffee clash, and let's talk about plants once we figure out what kind of flower it is. Apps, I have yet to find one that works on the amazing diversity of what we have in California. They're just too East Coast oriented, and we have too many different types of plants here for them to be very useful. So these apps on your phone, so far I haven't yet found one. If you find one, tell us about it, because that would be great to know. But so far, I haven't been real impressed with those. And of course, your local garden center, they probably know the plant if it's growing in the landscape in the region, because it's flowering then, that they're probably selling it. You can just walk in and walk around until you find one, or take your phone, show them the picture. A pretty good chance at a local actual garden center that they would know, or the local botanical garden, that they would know at least roughly what it is and can get you closer on those Google search terms.
So I want to talk about two more things. As we were driving home and going through the hills in Southern California, and, you know, Grapevine area before that, like Pyramid Lake area, that area, just so Don knows what I'm talking about. So we're driving past the hills, and I'm looking at the vegetation. Now, this is natural vegetation. This is not something that anybody is planting or watering or anything. It's just, it's the hills. And the trees and bushes on the hills, I would say over half of them were dead sticks. They were just dry trunks. Some had fallen over and some were just still standing there, but not a hint of life on any of them. And I'm wondering how a plant that has gone without water in the summer its entire life is suddenly dying for drying out. Did they just not get any water in the winter and it just couldn't survive? Or
we just had one of the driest winters on record in California. Yes. And it is affecting native plants. The start of the fire season, it was true. Measurements of the moisture in native vegetation were the lowest ever recorded. So if a fire starts, it is highly, highly, highly combustible. And you're correct. And some species are probably going to come back from the roots or stems or something. Others may not. So it's quite possible that the depth of this drought and its impact on native vegetation could be severe. But yeah, I remember reading some of these figures as we were in April, May, you know, the beginning, going into the hot season, how the recordings of vegetation moisture and the soil moisture around them was the lowest that had ever been recorded. So yes, that could be affecting some of the plants and perhaps ultimately have some effect on their distribution. More to the point, fire. As you know, I mean, the fires are going to start and spread more rapidly.
Right. And I was thinking about how those hills were versus the desert places. And I'm thinking, in California, we have so many different regions and microclimates and whatever. What would be, if our climate change is making things so that they're getting drier in those hills, would it be a reasonable thing to do to go and get some seeds of plants that can live a little bit drier than the hills are right now and stick a few seeds in and hopefully get some
winter plant? No, I would urge that people not try to revegetate natural areas without guidance from ecologists about what they're planting there. There are a lot of concerns about introducing soil organisms inappropriately. There's a lot of concerns about putting in the wrong kinds of species that could become invasive. Revegetation is actually a complicated science and practice, and it requires botanists and ecologists working with nurseries that are free of Phytophthora to produce the plants to put in those areas that are appropriate. And you could actually do more damage to the native plant population by introducing something unintentionally. So it really needs to be done very, very carefully. Backing up though, I was looking at an article from April. All right, so a team of researchers in the Bay Area, second day of April, skies are clear over the San Francisco Bay Area, and these folks head up to do some testing. And Craig Clements, a professor at San Jose State University, said, quote, "I was shocked when we went up there because usually in April we have a lot of new growth and old growth, and we didn't see any new growth on the shrubs. We weren't seeing the lighter colored bright green new growth sprouting out of the growth. Usually when we take clippings of new stems, there weren't any. This has never happened. The lack of rain this season severely impacted the chaparral live fuel moistures. Never seen April fuels look so dry. No new growth anywhere in the chemise. April is climatologically the highest live FMC of the season, very scary." So they began the season, as we've said here, the soil is extremely dry, and this is statewide. This is a case that usually our droughts are regional to some degree. This is the entire state. So the native vegetation, the chaparral of Southern California, and the native stands of vegetation in the Bay Area are drier than they'd ever seen them. And just as a side note, the state of California has ordered all the national forests closed through Labor Day, so that people are not in the national forests having campfires and things like that, because things are so dry and the fire season is so dangerous this year. So this is an extreme situation, and it will, you know, I've talked to ecologists, we have customers who are in this field. We'll see changes in the vegetation. We'll see changes in the population stands. Revegetation after a fire is something that is done, you know, revegetation, replanting areas, but it needs to be done with considerable care that you don't end up creating a problem. So, you know, getting back to your initial question, no, that's something we should leave to botanists and ecologists. But it is a big concern, and it's one of the reasons these fires that we're seeing are so explosive, is because the vegetation is so dry, and there was no new growth, and the old wood is drier than ever. So if a fire does get started, it really, really goes rapidly.
And then the last thing that I was noticing as we came through the Central Valley driving up, other than the fact that it was so brown in the air, you couldn't see the hills on either side of the valley. But other than that, there were many, many areas where there were entire orchards that were dead and brown and gone. I mean, trees, real trees, and vineyards where all the vines were just dead and brown, and places where people had started bulldozing things over. And it's astonishing how.
Well, these are vineyards and orchards that were either on the federal water project or the state water project almost entirely for their tree crops, and have gotten none of their water allocations this year. And they've been very low on their allocations for the last couple of years. In some cases, everybody else in the other parts of the country are reading about almond orchards and all this kind of thing. Well, a lot of almond orchards were planted in the mid-1980s into the mid-1990s, and an almond orchard's lifespan is about 25 years. So in many cases, you're seeing, I just took mine out. I have had several acres of almonds. Seemed like a good year to remove them. And their yields had been declining. They were 32 years old. Their yields had been declining for the last 5 or 6 years, to the point that the cost of harvesting wasn't declining. The cost of irrigating them wasn't declining. The money I was getting from them was declining, so they came out. So we are seeing some of the natural changeover. And I realize a lot of people don't realize that orchards have a lifespan. As we grow orchards in California with very high density planting, lots of fertilizer, lots of water, pump them, get a lot of yield out of them, they begin to decline after a while, and 25 years is getting old for an almond tree. Walnuts can go a lot longer than that, at least the way they were planted in the past. But you are seeing some natural changeover. Also, a lot of those farmers, I don't want to get into politics, but we're taking a gamble by putting a woody crop on a water supply that is reliant on either the federal project or the state project, and which varies from year to year. The Shasta Reservoir is at a critically low level, to the point that even the city of Davis, which has primary water rights for a portion of the water coming out of the Sacramento River, which drains out of Shasta, has had that cut off, and the city of Davis just went back to the wells. Okay. The city of Davis is pretty resilient. They have not only surface water most of the time, but deep well water, which is what we're on now, and a whole bunch of shallower wells they aren't even touching. You drove past Pyramid Lake on your way up. That's owned by Los Angeles. Full. They haven't even touched it yet. They haven't even had to tap into that. So many water districts have multiple water sources or something they can fall back on. But in the San Joaquin Valley, there's two problems. And this is definitely a topic more for a public affairs show on Cater than a garden show. But it's relevant to some of you who live down there. Your water supply from the state or federal project is not consistent. And in the past, you were able to pump groundwater. But many parts of the San Joaquin Valley, they were over-pumping the groundwater. Subsidence, settling of the land, has taken several inches, if not a few feet, in some areas, which means that they're not just over-pumping the groundwater, the aquifers are basically collapsing on themselves. And there's one important canal down there that has been damaged by the subsidence of the groundwater pumping, to the point that canal needs to be repaired. So this is a big issue in the San Joaquin Valley. And I have people reading about this in other parts of the country contacting me going, are you guys okay for water? The Sacramento Valley, we're fine. Okay. It's a drought, but we have resilience to our water supplies. I can pump out of the ground and I'm in a groundwater basin that is considered stable. but down in the San Joaquin Valley, they can't keep pumping the groundwater and keep watering tree crops. So the problem is they have woody crops relying on an unreliable water source. How's that? That's a good summary, I hope, of what's going on down there. So a lot of them are just making the decision, take the trees out at this point. They may be the yields declining. Maybe the cost of the irrigation is going up. I read one grower of citrus down there who I happen to know on a Facebook group. They decided to sell because it was going to, the cost of irrigating their orchard was going to go up tenfold, 10 times this coming season. And they just decided it wasn't worth it anymore. So rather than rip out the trees, they just sold the orchard to someone else.
You are listening to KDRT LP 95.7 here in Davis, California.